worry, no sweets. Only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bro. Curry for
life. What's up, Beardos? Welcome to episode 39 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes on The Commentist Network at thecommentist.com. And you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we will find out where in the world Andy is, go over some vegan news, discuss our thoughts on the activist response to the Yulin Dog Meat Festival, and then conclude with an interview with Michelle Carrera, the founder of Chili's on Wheels, an emergency food relief public charity that provides vegan food to people in need. So, Andy, you've had quite the trek in this past week or two. Where have you been?
Well, I started in Virginia, and I'm currently in Phoenix, Arizona. So I've covered quite a bit of ground in the last week. Sadly, the Richmond Vegetarian or the Richmond Veg Fest had to get postponed due to a giant storm that ripped through and just destroyed the park where the festival was going to be.
Jeez.
It got postponed to July 9th, which means I won't be there at all because I'll be at the Animal Rights Conference in L.A. But I did get a chance to head down to Norfolk, Virginia to have a game night with some friends. And Norfolk is where the PETA headquarters are, at least the East Coast headquarters. And I guess that used to be the only place. So they had like a ton of employees there. And so the side effect of that is that it seems a lot of the businesses there have good vegan options.
Oh, cool.
I went to a place called Yorgo's Bagel Dashery, and they had like an extensive vegan menu. They have breakfast sandwiches and vegan cream cheese and all that stuff. And I got a sausage, egg, and cheese on a bagel sandwich, and it tasted exactly like how I remember Dunkin' Donuts breakfast sandwiches tasting.
Nice.
Which I used to get all the time before, you know, going to school. And I know that's not like the highest quality food ever, but I have yet to have a sandwich that tasted exactly like that. I've made way better versions of it, but it was just so cool to go and be able to pick up a sandwich like this and have it remind me of my childhood.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then from there, I, you know, zipped across the country. And I got to stop at a few places I haven't been before. I went to, or at least had food before, I went to Louisville, Kentucky, and I found a place called Half Peach Bakery and Cafe, which is an all-vegan bakery, but they also have some food items as well. And the thing that caught my eye immediately was that they had wonton soup. And I'm not used to seeing wonton soup on vegan menus for whatever reason. I'm used to seeing, you know, dumplings. But wonton soup, for some reason, usually seems to elude me. And that used to be one of my favorite things to eat. So I got it, and it was incredible. It was like one of the best soups I've ever had. It was so flavorful. It was just the right amount of salty. The wontons were great. They were filled with, you know, veggies, but also I think some kind of TVP, some sort of protein in there. And it just reminded me exactly of what I used to love. So I actually got a large to go as well so I could eat it as I was driving through the less than vegan friendly, you know, middle of the country drives where there's just a lot of, you know, you're stuck with Taco Bell or Subway or something if you're going to be eating food that you're not preparing yourself. And then the last place that I'm going to mention for now, although I had some adventures in Tucson, I'll talk about that next week because I'm about to go to Southern California, and I imagine I'm just going to be revisiting a lot of places we've already talked about before. So I'm going to save Tucson for next week's episode, but I went to Kansas City, which is a city that I really like a lot, and I always make sure to stop there. And I went to Mud Pie, which is their vegan bakery, but it's also a coffee house. And so I actually sat there and edited last week's episode there, and it's just a really chill environment. But I remembered that I had gotten an email from one of our listeners, David, who had a couple of recommendations, and I was scrolling through that last minute. And he mentioned Waldo Pizza, and I was like, huh, try some Kansas City pizza, see what they're all about. And I guess I've never really had proper, like, Midwest pizza before, so I was not accustomed to what their thin crust pizza is.
Yeah.
Are you?
No. I've never really been to the Midwest before.
Yeah, it's after having had it, I was like, okay, I remember people talking about this being their type of pizza. I ordered a pizza that was like on their thin crust, and they have three different types of vegan cheeses there. The whole place is not entirely vegan, but they have three different types of vegan cheeses. And David, whose last name is Ardell, said that they've, because they always request a certain blend of those three cheeses, they've put a button on their ordering system called the Ardell blend, which is equal parts of all three cheeses. So
that's awesome.
When I called and I was like, yeah, I'd like to get these cheeses mixed together. It's like, oh yeah, that's the Ardell blend. And I was like, wow, like that's the, that's the power of ordering stuff a lot. And you know, I think about when I moved to New Haven, Connecticut, the Chinese place that we always used to go to and order General Tso's tofu from, they never had it on the menu, but we ordered it so much, the next time they reprinted their menus, it was on there along with a couple other tofu dishes. So, but yeah, I got it, you know, I had like a, they had a vegan pesto, so I used that as the base, and they had vegan chicken, which it seemed like they were making it themselves. I couldn't tell exactly what it was, and it was really good, but the, like, the thin crust out there is like a saltine cracker, basically. and they cut it, it's around pizza, but they cut it in squares. So it's very odd. I still really enjoyed it, but I enjoyed it in the same way that I enjoy a deep dish pizza, which is like, it's not really what I would call a pizza, but it is sauce and crust and cheese, and I like those things. It's kind of, it's like more like a bread lasagna or something.
Still have never had a deep dish pizza. Would love to have one, though.
Yeah, I celebrate all pizzas. I celebrate all pizzas, but being from New Haven, I'm not someone that gets like super territorial about their pizza, but you know, New Haven, it's kind of one of the founders and they got a good thing going on. And that's definitely what I prefer, but I certainly enjoyed this. It was just like cheese and crackers almost, especially because they were cut like a square.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I do like that square cut pizza though. I'm into that.
Really?
Party pizza.
Party pizza? I don't know. I like a little crust with every slice.
Yeah, true. True.
So anyway, so those are my journeys thus far. We'll catch up with Tucson and beyond next week. Paul, you went out of the state.
I did.
You put anything interesting in that mouth of yours?
I did, yes. So I was, I think I mentioned last week's episode, I had just gotten to Long Beach Island in New Jersey. I've since come back, so I'm back in Connecticut. But I remember, because my family goes there for a week every summer. And I remember one summer, one of my vegan friends was just like, oh, yeah, there's like a vegan place on the island. And the whole island is like 18 miles long. It's probably a quarter of a mile wide at some places. It is very, very narrow. So there's really not. And it's cool, though, because there's not a lot of like, it's all mom and pop shops. You don't really see like, I don't know. You don't see McDonald's. I don't think there's any fast food places. Like you don't see any McDonald's. You don't see any Subways. You don't see any Taco Bells. You don't see any of that, which is cool, which is nice. But because of that, you also are like, oh, and because it's on the beach, so it's very seafoody. You're like, oh, not too many vegan places. So my friend a few years ago or sometime back was like, oh yeah, there's this vegan place on the island. And I was like, what? Because I've been going there basically my whole life and I didn't know about this. So there is a vegan restaurant. It's called Living on the Veg, which is a great name. Definitely run by punks because there's a lot of like hardcore and punk records, the Hanging Up, and their symbol is kind of like, instead of the Bad Brains lightning bolt hitting the Capitol building, it's like the lightning bolt hitting a lighthouse, which is kind of like the Long Beach Island icon, which is a sweet design. Uh-huh. They do have, I will say, it's kind of billed as a vegan restaurant. There are, I think they have a one of their types of wraps. Like there's two different wraps you can get, a spinach wrap and like a whole wheat wrap. And I think one of the wraps has honey in it and it's labeled. There's like a little asterisk in it. So you just kind of have to notice that. But other than that, I believe everything is fully vegan. So I've been going there every year multiple times since I found out about this place. I think the food is great. I went twice this year. And I know, I don't know if I've talked about my love of everything buffalo on this podcast before, but I love like buffalo chicken, buffalo, and just put buffalo sauce on anything and I love it. Recently I went like 5 days in a row eating buffalo things every single day. But that's besides the point. So I went to this place And I believe last year I ordered their like buffalo chicken sandwich. So I was like, all right, I'm not going to order something buffalo. So I look at the menu and I'm like, all right, there's this cool seitan sandwich. They have this homemade cheese sauce that they make. And it's, I'm pretty sure it's just like vegetables and nutritional yeast, but somehow tastes, but ends up tasting very, very cheesy, very liquidy. It's awesome. So there was this cool seitan sandwich. I was like, give me that sandwich. I'm not going to get buffalo. And they were like, I'm sorry, we're out of seitan today. So I was like, all right, I'm getting buffalo. So I ordered the buffalo chicken wrap. So that's what I got the first day, buffalo chicken wrap. It had like a ranch dressing on it. It was delicious. There was the chicken was tempeh, which I'm usually not a fan of, but they did it very good. And then the second day I went back and I said, all right, give me this other seitan sandwich. And they said, sorry, we're still out of seitan. So I was like, all right, I guess I'm getting the other buffalo thing that's on their menu. So I ordered, it was called like, I forget. It was like a cheesy buffalo sandwich. So it had the buffalo tempeh in it, but then it had also this, instead of like a ranch, the ranch dressing, it had this cheesy sauce that is so good. And it was just so good. And my mom went with me both times, and she got this. It was basically like a BLT. So they had the tempeh bacon, and that was also phenomenal. It had that cheesy sauce in it. I think some vegan mayo, and it was. If you're ever in Long Beach Island, which isn't a place that you just happen to be driving through, but if you ever go to Long Beach Island, definitely go to Living on the Veg. Probably one of my all time favorite places. So then. That's one thing. Then since I got back, the other kind of notable place I went to, really not like a vegan place at all. I just happened to go to this Doctor Who themed restaurant. Andy, do you like Doctor Who at all?
I have never seen a single episode.
So I've seen like 5 episodes, but I went with someone that is very into Doctor Who. So if you're really into Doctor Who, go to this place. It's called Pandorica, which is a Doctor Who reference. It's in Beacon, New York, which for me was only about an hour and a half. So I've traveled far, far longer distances for food. So I went to there. There is, I believe, a single vegan item on the menu, which was falafel, the go-to for vegans, for a vegan option. You got to get it without the tzatziki sauce, obviously. Can't get the fries because those have bacon on them. So yeah, there's...
That sounds so sad, Paul.
Yeah, I mean... The food-wise, it was mediocre. It's if you want a decent falafel, a mediocre falafel, go for it. If you really like Doctor Who, then you'll probably love it there. But it's nice that they have at least one vegan thing. So, Pandorica in Beacon, New York. And that's what I got.
Sounds like a place I will never go.
Probably not.
Oh, man. You did. I'm pretty sure you professed your love for all things Buffalo 1 or 2 episodes ago. Okay. So
that's good. So it'll be a reoccurring thing now.
Yes. Hey, Paul, this just in.
Yes.
We got a comment on our Instagram.
Okay. Shut the fuck up about Buffalo, Paul. Oh, okay.
Dim Sim Kitty said, Gregor is definitely Seinfeld, not Goldblum.
Oh. But did you see that new movie with Dr. Gregor, Independence Day Resurgence?
Paul, I did see it. Dr. Gregor was the best part of that film, but the film was horrible. Even Dr. Gregor and all of his nutrition facts could not save that film.
Oh boy.
But anyway, I didn't meet any beardos on my travels because I wasn't doing any events. So I just want to give a shout out to everyone that has been giving us some nice rates and reviews on iTunes. We just got one the other day from Vegan Stella. So Thank you to Vegan Stella for doing that.
Thank you. So let's get into the news. There is, I was in Whole Foods the other day, which is not a surprise because I'm there every other day, but I was in Whole Foods the other day. Someone was giving out, I saw this thing. It said like pulled pork. They do demos every once in a while. I was like pulled pork. And I was like, thought it would be something good. But then I looked a little closer and I saw pulled pork jackfruit. And I was like, yes, please. So I went over, I grabbed one of these pulled pork jackfruits. It was delicious. It was Upton's, which is no surprise because that stuff is delicious. And next to it on the same table, there was a flyer, a little pamphlet thing for this new movie coming out called At the Fork. So let's listen to a trailer for this movie.
All right, I think these babies are ready to go. I love my big Italian family. My family loves their food.
And then...
Oh, yes, and there's the bacon.
There's the bacon.
But not my whole family. For the past 10 years, my vegetarian wife has been trying to convince me to take a closer look at just how these ribs ended up on my plate. So I agreed to set out on a journey to visit the farms, meet the animals.
Oh my gosh, he's huge.
And question the farmers.
So why did you speak out?
I just felt like the consumer was being lied to.
And what we found surprised us.
Caring about animals, caring about where your food comes from, caring about how your food is produced is just part of a larger shift in all of civilization.
Man does have dominion over the animals. Man does have a calling to be a steward of the animals.
With animals, you're talking about living beings that have feelings, they have emotions, that's been proven, but dominion does not mean complete domination.
I don't have to cause the death of somebody else to survive.
Yes, I ethically justify eating meat, but we've got to give animals a good life. We've got to give them a life worth living.
I am not an animal.
So from the film's website, filmmaker and omnivore John Popola, together with his vegetarian wife Lisa, offer up a timely and refreshingly unbiased look at how farm animals are raised for our consumption. With unprecedented access to large-scale conventional farms, Popola asks the tough questions behind every hamburger, glass of milk, and baby back rib. What he discovers are not heartless industrialists, but America's farmers, real people who, along with him, are grappling with the moral dimensions of farming animals for food.
You sound like you were laughing when you said that.
I may have had a smirk on my face. So I think that perhaps the trailer is a bit more vague than this description is, but what was your impression of this trailer, Paul?
Well, it starts off as almost every one of these like vegan conversion movies start off as, is that like, I was from an American family and it shows them like grilling up a lot of meat, blah, 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 meat, 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 meat. And I expected it to go, and then he says, and my wife is vegetarian, and I expected it to go like, and that's when I decided I would try meatless, duh, 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 and then like happy music plays and it shows him like hugging animals and stuff like that. But that's not really where it goes to. It's more of just like, oh, my wife convinced me to kind of like visit farms and look at where the food is coming from. So it doesn't in no, I don't believe, unless they're trying to keep this secret, it doesn't seem like he becomes vegetarian or vegan. I mean, maybe he does at the end of the movie and they just didn't want to show that in the trailer. But it seems like he still stays eating meat, and it's more just kind of looking at farms. It seemed very small farm centric. Like it seems like it's just going to mostly look at small farmers. I did get the sense that it was trying to make it seem, from the trailer, that the main message of the movie is buy from small humane raised farms. Did you get that message?
Well, they never explicitly state that, but there's a number of factors that lead me to feel like that. One is the fact that the trailer is not explicitly vegan centric. And actually, something that's interesting to me is that in that description that I just read, it refers to his wife, Lisa, as being vegetarian. And he says that in the trailer as well. But there is another video on their website that's explaining, you know, how the screenings work. And it's through Tug, which I believe that's Cowspiracy probably did some stuff through that, maybe, where it's, you know, you set up a screening. And a certain number of people have to buy tickets before the screening actually happens. It's like one of those things. So there's a video explaining that. And in that video, he refers to his wife as vegan. So even in the trailer, they use the word vegetarian and not vegan. So I don't have high hopes for this because it's being sponsored. All these screenings are being sponsored by Whole Foods and Humane Society. But it would be really cool if they are leading people to think it's a video about why you should, you know, purchase humane meat except, you know, small farms. But then the guy just ends up going vegan anyway.
And you know what? Maybe that is what will happen, because that's like, because I'm trying to think about the reasoning why they would use the term vegetarian in the trailers rather than vegan. And I mean, the reason I can think is because they want more people that eat meat to watch this movie, and hearing the word vegan is going to turn them off from eating meat. Whereas I think a lot of people are not opposed to like trying to eat better. And if you phrase it that way, people are more likely to watch this movie than just saying like, oh, this is a movie about going vegan. And then people that eat meat aren't really going to want to watch that.
Yeah.
So hopefully that's what's happening. But there was like one of the farmers, or I'm assuming was a farmer towards the end of the trailer, says something like just because we're like killing these animals doesn't mean that we shouldn't like give them the best life that they can possibly have, or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was what really solidified it as like, oh, that's what this movie is going to be about.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, they feature Temple Grandin. So, you know, that is a person renowned for reforming how we kill animals, but still is unwilling to change her stance on the fact that, you know, we should or should not kill animals. So that's in there, but it's like, okay, she could just be in there for balance, you know? And it would be very smart if this film was a film that doesn't explicitly state we're trying to get you to go vegan, in the way that Cowspiracy, you know, they frame it as what's this environmental conspiracy that's, you know, happening right now. And then eventually, you know, the film leads you down that path of like, well, you should go vegan. So this could be a film like that. I don't think it actually is. We're gonna review this film in a couple of weeks. There are screenings taking place on July 13th, and you can go to atthefork.com if you want to attend one of them and see if there's one near you. But on the website, this is kind of a spoiler alert in terms of the things that we've been surmising, but there is, at the top of the thing, there are tabs for organize a screening, watch the trailer, see the film, and then take the challenge. And you click on take the challenge, it takes you to a page where there is a 21-day challenge, essentially. And The description says, you'll receive 21 days of higher welfare and plant-based recipes with a daily challenge recipe from featured chefs. So I'm assuming higher welfare, that's saying go purchase from Whole Foods or purchase from small farms.
Yeah.
So,
and also keep in mind, this flyer was being given out with Upton's jackfruit too, which is, the plot thickens.
Yeah, that was interesting. And I mean, you know, so being sponsored by like Whole Foods, it's like, we know that John Mackey wants people to be vegan, or at least that's what he says. We've had extensive conversations about whether or not, you know, how that may conflict with the fact that he actually sells and, you know, makes it more palatable for people to exploit animals. But we know that personally he advocates for veganism. You know, we saw him do a speech on why you should go vegan. So maybe ultimately it will be thing that something that's like heavily leaning towards you should go vegan.
Yeah. The trailer would be misleading then.
But, you know, it could be the old bait and switch.
Yeah. So we're going to watch that movie, and which is what, July 13th, I believe. And then we'll record an episode right after that. So you can probably expect our review on it in about 3 weeks.
Yeah. So stay tuned to see if any of our assessments were correct or totally off base.
So let's move on.
This next news item, it's interesting. It's not exactly news because it sort of came out about a year ago, but I've seen it making its rounds again in a lot of vegan groups on Facebook. So I thought it'd be interesting to bring it up and get your impression of this whole thing. Because I think regardless of the timeliness of it, it just brings up some interesting hypothetical situations that I'm really curious to see how you would respond to them, Paul.
Okay.
So
let me have it.
All right. So, there was outrage that Hampton Creek, it was found out, is making a non-vegan cookie. And what this is in their food service, like, you know, commercial available product, not in anything that's available in stores, although their cookies are currently hitting the shelves. I know people in New York have already found them in like Target and whatnot. But the white chocolate chip in their white chocolate macadamia nut cookie contains dairy. And the way people found out about this, well, I don't know how people found out about it, but the thing that gets circulated is Hampton Creek responding to someone's comment asking about it on their website. So Hampton Creek's response is, "We hear you and truly appreciate your thoughts. So the context for our white chocolate macadamia nut flavor of Just Cookies is that they are reformulated specifically for our food service supplier, Compass Group. These cookies are only served in universities and hospitals, not available for retail. And we've already removed all the eggs and are next removing all the dairy as well. And just to be clear, our Just Cookie dough that's available in retail stores is completely made of plants." So I thought this was kind of interesting because, you know, they're a company that strays away from calling themselves vegan. They're just really trying to be as mainstream as possible. But it's still, they have that, they're run by vegans and they have that mission of, you know, being as sustainable as possible. Obviously, dairy is not very sustainable. So, Paul, what do you make of this?
Well, the first thing that strikes me as odd is that white chocolate macadamia nut is such a specific flavor of cookie. And it's like the white chocolate chip in particular. And I mean, obviously I'm not producing something on a massive scale, but I would think that regular chocolate chip cookies for me are pretty easy to find vegan. So I would think that they would maybe be a lot easier to produce vegan. So my first initial impression is just like, why not just do a different flavor or use like regular chocolate chips? So that's kind of weird, unless for some specific reason they found out that like this specific flavor of cookie would do phenomenally well. But again, it seems so specific that I can't imagine that. So I don't know. It seems very bizarre to me.
Yeah, it's I mean, I know that like Subway has a white chocolate macadamia cookie, so it is one of the more well-known flavors. But I think if someone said,
"Are you calling out my knowledge of cookie flavors as flawed, Andy?"
When's the last time you went to a Subway, Paul? But I'm saying, like, if someone was like, "What are the most popular cookies?" It'd be like chocolate chip, oatmeal raisin, peanut butter.
Yeah,
I don't know if. Maybe chocolate chip. I don't know where I would put white chocolate macadamia nut.
Yeah.
So that was my initial impression was, oh, why don't they just not make that flavor?
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, leave out the white chocolate chips? Or I hadn't thought of your suggestion of make it chocolate chip macadamia nut cookie or something.
All of the cookie enthusiasts out there are just shaking their heads in disappointment at that suggestion.
How dare you? So I did a little digging. I talked to some folks and, you know, read further into comments that were being made. And
you made a documentary about it called Macadamia Conspiracy.
Yes. Macspiracy.
Macspiracy.
And so from what I gather, no one from Hampton Creek, I think, has officially gone on the books about this, but Compass Group required that flavor to be made. And they brought them some white chocolate chips, and the Compass Group rejected every white chocolate chip that they brought to them.
Like, and Hampton Creek made, you're assuming, vegan white chocolate chips and brought that to them?
Either they made it or they were sourcing it from somewhere. Yeah. And I guess, to be fair, any vegan white chocolate chip that I've had has not been the best.
Yeah. Never
have. So the situation that I can deduce from all the information I have is that there was a huge contract on the table, and in order for it to go through, they had to produce this cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to produce that cookie to the standards of Compass Group, it required, at the current time, using a white chocolate chip that has dairy in it.
I just imagine Compass as like a a guy with a cigar and monocle, like banging on a table, like, you have to make chocolate, white chocolate macadamia nut cookies, or get the hell out of my office.
I picture him like just daintily picking up one of the white chocolate chips that they supply and tasting it and going, next. And then just like trying the next one. No, not good enough. So now this becomes a situation where it's not like Hampton Creek went out of their way to produce this non-vegan product. It seems that they are saying, in order for us to get a ton of vegan products into stores, we need to unfortunately make this one non-vegan product. So I'm glad I'm not in their situation, but yeah. Paul, if you were in their situation, how would you weigh those two things out? Where do you think you would fall? Would you say it's worth it to get my foot in the door with this giant company to hopefully get a ton of vegan products out there? Or it's more important to stick by our principles and not make a single thing that is the result of an animal product?
Well, the reason
at the loss of this contract.
The reason why I think that this is okay, and of course, like, they would say this, but you would hope that they're acting on it. The reason why I think this is definitely okay is that they use this massive contract as a way to get their foot in the door, and they respond to that person on Facebook saying, we're working on removing all dairy as well as all eggs. So it's like they're working on it. And again, like I said, of course they would say that even if they're not, but you would hope that they are doing that. And as a company that seems like they really stick to their ethics, I have no doubt that they like weighed the pros and cons of this. And I'm sure even though Andy did a masterful job at investigating this and digging up all the dirt, I'm sure that like there's other stuff that we aren't thinking about that happened. And I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt here and say that they had to do this to make this deal. They tried other things and that didn't work out. So it's like, to the best of their ability, they tried to make it 100% vegan, but dirty old Compass just wouldn't have it. I'm picturing Compass in my head as the bad guy from Space Jam, the guy that's smoking the cigar. That's Compass to me. So I think it's completely acceptable, especially if they are working to make it dairy free. I think that Hampton Creek their image has not been tarnished to me. I mean, there's plenty of vegan products that we buy that also sell non-vegan things. So I think Hampton Creek, in comparison to the majority of companies, is doing pretty good. So is doing phenomenally. So I'm still going to boost their stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and to make it clear, it definitely was that in order to make this contract happen, they had to make this product.
Mm-hmm.
So, I spent at least 30 minutes looking into this, Paul. So
At least.
Like a bare minimum of 30
Maybe
minutes.
Maybe even 32 minutes.
Well, let's not get carried away. for contrast's sake, there was in 2014, Field Roast, there's like a big thing where in order for them to continue selling their products in Canada, they had to conduct animal testing. And we'll put a link to an article about this up in the show notes because I don't want to get super involved in it. So that was like the other route they were just like, fine, we're just not going to sell our products in Canada.
Whoa.
And so by applying the logic of, well, it's okay to, you gotta break a few eggs to make an omelet type thing. Do you think that trade-off is worth it? Like, now all of a sudden a ton of people don't have access to their products.
Yeah,
all for the sake of not testing on, I'd imagine, a relatively small amount of animals.
And again, like, neither of us, well, at least I can't say I know how the animal testing procedure is done, but I would think, and I could be wrong, I would think it's like you're doing the testing. And then once the testing is done, it either gets approved or denied. And once it's approved, then you don't have to do any more testing unless you change stuff up. So like, that's how it seems. That's how it makes sense in my head as how it would seem like it would go. So it's that even adds another layer where it's not like there's a non-vegan product there's not a non-vegan ingredient in the Field Roast. So it's not like it would continually be not vegan. It would just be like there's this set amount of animals that they would have to do this to get the product out. So that's, I don't know. That's really tough too. I mean, I totally give them credit for saying, no, we're not going to do this. And, give them props for saying, no, we're not going to do this. And like sticking to their ethics and saying, we're not going to harm animals. But I'm going to be honest. I probably, if this was like to get, because you just said, oh, to get their product, in order to sell their product in Canada, I don't know if this is just like, they're selling it at that like one small whole, like natural food store, or if this is like they're getting their product sold at every Walmart in Canada or something like that. So I think that would weigh into it as well. But I mean, like we've said in the, I don't know, maybe you'll disagree with me, Andy, but like we've mentioned in the podcast before, it's like we want people to kind of to go vegan for the future animals that aren't even around yet, not as much for like the animals that have already been killed and like their meat is already in being packaged. So it's like I don't think if Field Roast had chosen to do that in order to get their product like widely distributed to Canada, I don't know if I would really blame them for it if they really thought that like their product being out there would make people that would normally eat meat not eat meat, and therefore prevent like all these future deaths from happening. I don't know. It's like the train track problem where it's like you have to choose.
It's exactly the trolley problem for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to choose which bad thing to happen. But I will say, again, kudos to them for not just doing it to make money, because obviously doing the animal testing, getting their product more widely distributed would make them more money. So that's really nice to see that they're not completely in this just to make the most amount of moolah that they can.
Yeah. And just in case anyone wasn't aware, after about 8 months, they did find a solution. They call it a temporary solution. So I assume that they're back in Canada now. So it is available in Canada again. And I do think that what Hampton Creek and what Field Roast are trying to do are two very different things. You know, Field Roast is kind of this boutique brand, fairly expensive. You know, like the hamburgers are like, it's like $8.99, I think, for like four burgers or something along those lines, at least any place I've found them. So they're not trying to do the same thing at all. So they get, you know, a good boost in the vegan community by showing that they're sticking to their guns. Whereas I think Hampton Creek kind of doesn't really care that all that much about the vegan community's opinion.
Yeah.
Because I think they're like, we know what we're doing, our cause is righteous, and you know, the opinion of vegans, which are a very, you know, small minority of the population, is not as important as actually saving the animals. And unfortunately for us, we think the best way to do that means making this non-vegan, you know, white chocolate chip cookie for the time being.
Their cause may be righteous, Andy, but is their cause just? Mayo.
Paul, why don't you wait in the car? So, and then the one last thing I wanted to ask you, and this is very much a trolley problem, mm-hmm. but in a comment thread on one of these things I saw, people were, you know, obviously going back and forth about this. And one person said, if I could get five people to go vegan next year in exchange for me eating a grilled cheese today, I would do it. So this is a hypothetical. There's no situation in which someone's like, if you eat that grilled cheese, I'll go vegan next year. But
and I'll get four of my buddies to do it too.
Yes. Would you eat that grilled cheese, Paul?
I think that I would. Like, interesting. Just from this straight up. Like, I'm not thinking about anything outside of what this ridiculous hypothetical situation is proposing. The amount, I feel like the pros vastly outweigh the cons in that situation. Like, think about how many, Andy, think about how many grilled cheeses five people eat in 1 year. And you're preventing all of those grilled cheeses by just eating one grilled cheese.
Yeah.
So I think that I would. I mean, also, yeah, yeah, I think that I would.
I thought you cared about animals, Paul. Guess I was wrong.
Would you?
My way to circumvent it is I would find some dumpster cheese and make a grilled cheese.
No, 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 no. You have to play by the rules of this hypothetical situation, which is outrageous.
I have to like go to the store and purchase a Kraft single and make a grilled cheese?
Yes.
I don't know. Because also it kind of sends the message that vegans are flexible on their ethics, you know, even though I think we're all very flexible on our ethics. We talk about that all the time on the show, how we all kind of accept certain amount of animal death in our lives, and we all draw that line at a different point.
Yeah, and I think going along that line, it's like I would be able to accept that this one grilled cheese that I'm eating, knowing that it's going to further like the vegan cause. I think that in our lives, we do a lot more harm for nothing, you know? I mean, we're like, you know, we're driving cars every day. We're doing all sorts of stuff that's bad for the animals, bad for the environment every single day for no benefit to the animals or the environment. Whereas at least in this hypothetical situation, I would be consciously doing something that I know is harmful for some benefit. And it's like a one-time thing. Unless there's any fine print.
You must continue to eat a grilled cheese every day.
Constantly. It's all you can eat.
One grilled cheese per person per year.
So yeah, I think I would. I mean, again, this is like a ridiculous situation.
This is what we deal with on the show, Paul.
Goldblum.
Seinfeld.
So let's get into a more serious topic, which is the Yulin Dog Festival that every year, I feel like around this time, you start to see vegans and non-vegans posting about this on the internets.
So this is a festival that started in 2009, and by the accounts, the self-reported accounts, there is about 10,000 dogs that die over this 10-day festival, so about 1,000 dogs a day. And it's a pretty small minority of people that do attend this festival. So it's not like it's some thing that's been going on for like hundreds of years. And some people say it was just sort of made to kind of boost the sale of dog meat in southern China. But for whatever reason, this is something that people seem to latch onto every year, despite the fact that there are festivals that cause the death of, you know, many thousands of animals happening all over the place, including in the United States. There's bacon festivals here. There's, you know, rib festivals and things of that nature. So this is something that we see, like Paul said, every time this year people start making posts. And I believe we have brought this up on the show before. Yeah. I couldn't find the episode specifically that it was. So I guess it wasn't ever a main discussion that we had. But we have discussed it. And I think what made us want to talk about it again, aside from it just being a timely thing, and still we see all these comments that are being made, and we can dive into what those specific comments are saying and what they actually mean, what the subtext is. But people this time went above and beyond making Facebook posts or making petitions for those to sign. And there's actually some protesters that went down to Chinatown in New York City to protest the Dog Meat Festival happening in southern China.
So this is from an article on a website called Reappropriate about this protest. Let me pull this up. And it says, last Friday, roughly 20... And so there's an obvious bias to this article. Last Friday, roughly 20 misguided animal rights activists took to the streets of New York City's Chinatown to protest the consumption of dog meat in southern China. The animal rights activists claim they are interested in advocating that China ban dog meat festivals. Yet, to accomplish this, they spent a day harassing Chinese-American restaurant owners and patrons, most of whom have zero connection with the Yulin Dog Meat Festival, with a message of cultural intolerance and nativism. Said one protester to the New York Daily News, "That's not how we roll in our country. If they bring that tradition to our country, they'll be investigated and will go to jail," he said.
So, yeah, we've talked about in the past how a lot of the activism around this festival is very xenophobic and racist. I think mainly for the fact that we see people who there's like the hypocrite factor. There's the people that do consume animals that live in the United States that all of a sudden care about this festival that's happening, the Yulin Dog Meat Festival. It's also a lychee festival. But that never gets brought up.
Ooh, lychee. The grossest of all the fruits. Ban it.
So where's lychee produced? Can we go protest?
Chinatown.
Just for being gross. You know, there's like the hypocrite factor of people who consume animals on a daily basis, all of a sudden being concerned about animals that are being consumed halfway around the world. Purely for the factor of it's a dog or a cat and it's an animal that in our culture we hold to some high, you know, regard, and, you know, we take them into our homes, they become members of the families. And so there's that factor. But then it comes to vegans, and okay, that hypocrisy factor is gone because they sort of see the slaughter of all animals as equal. Yet it still kind of settles it still, you know, rubs the wrong way because there's so many animals for us to be saving on our own soil. Why do we need to all of a sudden try and travel halfway around the globe to deal with something that there are animal activists out there in China that do work on this? And also, by all accounts, this isn't something that the majority of the population even likes to participate in or like morally can get behind. They've done polls that show that 64% is the lowest percentage I've seen of China disapproves of this festival. So why do we need Americans to, you know, sort of prey on this xenophobia? They prey on this xenophobia that we have and the kind of like that ick factor of like, oh, they eat dogs. They eat these weird things in this other culture. And it just sort of, you know, really reinforces some negative attitudes that we have in this country towards Chinese people.
And I feel like the quote that they have from the protester just like really embodies that. Like the quote, "That's not how we roll in our country." Yeah. It's like that's such a gross statement.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like that's not how we roll. Instead, we torture chickens and pigs and cows. Like,
yeah.
That is, yeah, how we roll in this country is horrific and
yeah.
horribly oppressive to, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of animals.
And it's funny because for some reason this did not pop in my head, but when you said we basically do the same thing with like bacon festivals or like rib festivals and stuff like that, it is quite literally the same. Like, I don't know if it's exactly the same thing, but it seems like it's very, very similar, just with different animals that are in the United States more acceptable to eat, where in other countries that might not be acceptable to eat.
Yeah. And I think that I think the big sticking point that a lot of people argue when this gets brought up is that part of the Yulin festival is that supposedly it's considered that the dogs taste better if they've gone through some like horrific trauma beforehand, if they've gone through a lot of terror and or experienced a lot of terror and gone through a lot of pain. And yikes. People would like to think that the animals that are consumed in our country are treated well, which we know is straight up not true at all.
But so, Andy, the 5-step Whole Foods thing.
I know. John Mackey has reassured us that everything's okay. as long as we have Tyler from Sugar Creek Meats raising and killing animals for us, we're good.
Good old American boy, Tyler.
Yes. So there may be some difference in how these animals are treated. And to me, I don't think that that's enough of a difference to feel any sort of moral high ground on that, on the part of those that do participate in, say, a bacon festival in the United States versus the Yulin Dog Meat Festival.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even if you could argue that the animals are treated better here, and I'm sure it's marginally better, but even if it was significantly better, I don't think it's enough to warrant spending time and energy protesting, whether in person or on Facebook, enough, you know, to justify that time and energy spent protesting something happening halfway around the world when there are plenty of opportunities to do so in your own backyard in ways that are not going to reinforce racism and xenophobia. Although the animal rights movement here does a pretty good job of doing that as well.
Zing.
Slam.
Self-burn.
Yeah. The rarest type of burn. So, I don't know, Paul, what do you think?
Yeah, like the thing that struck me that this article does a great job of bringing up is that it's like what were they trying to accomplish by like targeting Chinatown and New York City? Like were they trying to be like, hey, you should be outraged about this too? Were they trying to be like, hey, you should stop participating in this? Like, were they that kind of, I don't know if oblivious is the right word, but it just doesn't seem like they did a lot of or any real research,
yeah,
about it. Because it's like they're targeting these random people that probably couldn't do that much to stop it over here in New York City, Chinatown.
Yeah, in the article it says they wanted to go to China, but then the visas didn't quite work out. And I'm like, yeah, right. You weren't trying to ever go to China. But you're just using that as like an excuse to be like, oh, we tried to go spend thousands of dollars on plane tickets, but instead we're like, let's just go downtown. Let's go to Chinatown and yell at some random people that we assume are Chinese.
What would Moby have to say about that?
I think he would shake his head.
His slightly haired head.
And he would sigh and go. And I think that the biggest thing for those of us, like, I just take a step back for a second. I think both of us are obviously horrified by any animal exploitation. Mm-hmm. And this is in no means to excuse what's happening over there, over at the Yulin Festival. But I think it's important for us to keep into perspective how we do our activism and to make sure that we're not doing it in a way that preys upon pre-existing, you know, fears and prejudices that we have. And I think that this festival very much does that. And so I guess, you know, that kind of leads to the question of like, well, how can we actually help do something about this in a way that does not prey on those things? And like my first suggestion would be like, go find something in your own country to work on, because you'll probably be way more effective at getting it done.
Yeah.
But I also think that it's important that if you need to do something about this, if you're so compelled to do something about this, it's, to me, it would be all about supporting the activists that are over there that are doing that work already. Like, we don't need a petition from some country that's like, oh, it's gross to eat dogs, and then we're going to sign all these petitions and send it over there because we're going to tell them how to do what they need to do, you know?
Yeah, and actually, if you don't mind, I would like to read a little bit more from that article that kind of goes over just that.
Go for it.
It says, never mind, of course, that animal rights are increasingly an important issue for Chinese citizens amid rising dog ownership among China's wealthy and middle class. Since the festival's inception in 2009, it has faced profound public backlash within China as activists gather at the festival and purchase and save dogs destined for slaughter. A recent poll suggested that as many as two-thirds of Chinese people oppose animal cruelty and support animal products produced humanely. Yet last week's animal rights protesters in New York City ignored the burgeoning Chinese animal rights movement and in so doing erased their work. Instead, they assumed that the West's moral superiority regarding the ethical treatment of animals is needed to save Chinese people from our own barbarism. So I think that combined with what Andy already said is just like, there's already people doing this work that are going to be way more effective for the sole reason that they understand their own culture better than you or I would. So like, support those people. I think that's how you can, that's if, and I mean, you should be upset about this because it's something that's very upsetting. And I think that that's how you can do something about it, is you can support the people over in China that are already doing something about it, and don't kind of discredit the work that they're doing. And especially if they're purchasing like the dogs in order to save them, they obviously probably need monetary support. So I think there are ways that you can support them that aren't just kind of being like us going to another country and telling them what to do, because that's really not going to make people change their minds.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And one last line that I will read from this article, which again, link to that in the show notes. They didn't need to trample over the work of Chinese animal rights activists by reinforcing the narrative of Eastern backwardness and Western enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I feel like, you know, there's only so many ways that we can say, knock it off. So I think we've said that pretty effectively, or at least efficiently right now. So we're not going to harp on it too much, unless you have anything else to say, Paul.
Yeah, I was going to say, and again, we're not saying like, don't be upset about this, or don't be mad about this, or don't be okay with this. That's not what we're saying. What we are saying, though, is besides just trying to be, you know, culturally sensitive and a good person, like, also think about, like we've preached a billion times before and we'll preach a billion times after this, like, think about what you're going to do and how it's going to have an impact on for animals, because like not to say that these protesters weren't justifiably mad about this, like what they're doing in my opinion is not going to further like any of our causes, and in fact probably would hurt it, because it's going to give vegans a bad name. So
definitely. And I guess one last takeaway, and this has been a consistent theme on our show, is for those that do see people making posts about this, especially those who are not vegan, again, this is an opportunity for us to be able to talk to those folks and sort of build off of the empathy that they have for these dogs, and hopefully get them to expand their moral compass, their moral sphere for animals that are killed and slaughtered for food in the United States as well. So again, resist that urge to scream hypocrite at people. And if you can take a gentler approach and say, hey, it's so awesome that you care about this issue, have you thought about this issue instead? That's a way that we can use this situation, which seems to pop up every year, to our advantage, to let people know, hey, you already care about animals. Let's talk about how you can help animals even more in your daily, you know, consumption, as opposed to something that other people around the globe are doing. So I think that's a good place to leave it off. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with our interview with Michelle Carrera from Chili's on Wheels. The biggest injustice of Chili's on Wheels is that they didn't go for the rhyme of Chili's on Willies.
Chili's on Willies.
Chili's on Willies. I mean, that's the only thing that Meals on Wheels does better, is that it has a rhyme.
Chili's on Willies.
Yeah, so it's a really great interview. And of course, we always love to hear what you think about the issues that we talk about on the show. Best ways to do that, you can reach us at email, thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. You can also go to thecommentist.com and comment on individual episodes, or you can connect with us on our Instagram at thebeardedvegans. So we will be right back with our interview with Michelle Carrera.
So before we get to our interview, let's just take a quick break and talk about thecommentist.com. That's the commentist, commentist.com.
Can you spell the for me again?
T-H-E. Thecommentist.com, where you can find The Bearded Vegans and a lot of other great podcasts. So check out all of the archive, all the old Bearded Vegans episodes, comment on those. We see those comments whenever they pop up. Check out some other cool podcasts, and yeah, just have a great time overall at thecommentist.com, a place for comments.
All right, let's get back to the show. Our guest today is Michelle Carrera, the founder of Chili's on Wheels. It is a pleasure to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's so cool. Thanks.
Cool. So we always like to start at the beginning. And so I'm curious, what brought you to veganism? What did that journey look like for you?
So I went vegan 15 years ago this February, and I was living in Puerto Rico. That's where I grew up and I was raised. And I was 21 years old, and my sister got a baby chick for Easter. They used to give them out in schools. You know, sometimes they would dye them different colors, whatever, horrid. But so ours actually was taken care of, and he grew into a rooster. He took over the backyard. He was just like a dog. Like, you know, you would call him. His name is Piolín, which means Tweety Bird in Spanish. And, you know, you'd call him Piolín, Piolín, and he would just, you know, waddle, run over whatever he was in the backyard to greet you. He loved cuddles. So anyway, so he was just, you know, it just kind of sent off alarm bells, right? Like, how can I eat chickens if they're just like dogs? You know, he has a personality. How can I do this, right? And then that became, how can I eat any sentient being? How can I eat any animal? And about like 2 weeks into being vegetarian, I was just kind of doing research. And, you know, I came across for the first time the word vegan. I never even heard it. I mean, this is in the early 2000s. I had never even heard the word vegan. And so I said, you know, why not? If I'm already going vegetarian and I'm still kind of, you know, struggling to how to fit this into my life, I might as well. This is the reason why. It's for animal cruelty. So why not just get rid of all of it? So I went vegan like 2 weeks into being vegetarian.
Right on. Very fast transition.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And so you're a pretty accomplished activist. And did veganism lead you to activism, or are you already engaging in activism at that point?
Yeah, so at the beginning, I didn't really, I mean, I don't want to say that I didn't care about anything, but pretty much, you know, and I really didn't care a whole lot about people after being, you know, after turning vegan, just because people are the ones that, you know, that are doing all these atrocities to animals. And so, you know, it was pretty much the stereotype of the angry vegan for a while. And, you know, I was reading about the Personhood Project for the apes, and I was reading a lot about it. It just went through a phase where I read everything I could find my hands on it, and I can just kind of realize, like, okay, so yeah, we say that they share, the chimps and other apes share 99% of our DNA, and so yeah, we need to treat them just like people. But then that kind of got me thinking, wait, like who? Because there's a lot of people that we don't treat so well. and so you know, that's, so animals brought me to people, you know, animals, compassion for animals is what brought me to compassion to people. And yeah. And so then I took off from there.
And so compassion for people right there, that brings us to Chili's on Wheels. At what point did Chili's on Wheels enter the equation? And, you know, what was sort of the inspiration for starting it?
So fast forward a lot of years, after that, you know, then having started compassion for people, and I worked, most of my working life has been with nonprofits, and for diverse things, adult literacy and just other things. And that my son was born, and he was around 4 years old, and I realized that most of our activism with him and most of the topics of conversation had been around animals or the environment, but not a lot with, you know, with community, with people. And so for Thanksgiving of 2014, I was looking for a vegan soup kitchen. I thought that would be a great place to start with teaching my son how to, you know, how to be a part of the community, how to look out after one another. And unfortunately, my search came up empty. There was no vegan soup kitchen in New York City. And so, so then I decided, well, let's just do it ourselves then. Let's just make a few meals ourselves in our kitchen and take them out. And that it was an epic day. I mean, it was like the first snow of the season. It was a winter that would turn out to be pretty harsh. So it just, once you're out there and you see people, and you know, we were talking to people and seeing them eat really fast because they're hungry. And just seeing this firsthand is something I couldn't unsee it. And so I, you know, initially I had gone into it thinking, oh, this will be a nice thing that I can do once a year, you know, with my son for Thanksgiving. But it, just seeing it, I couldn't, just leave it to a once a year thing. You know, I realized this is something that that needs to be done now, ASAP, you know, this. And so then it kind of grew to once a week, which is what we have now. Several chapters, different cities. I mean, it just kind of blew out of proportion, blew out of hands. It was amazing.
And do you just serve chili? Do you have other foods that you branch out to?
Everything that we make is vegan, but we have started to serve other kind of stuff. For the summer, chili is not really the thing that you'd want to eat because I chose chili in the winter because it's something that warms you up. So in the summer, it doesn't make sense. And so now we're doing like salads and pasta and just other types of food. Also, sometimes we have pizza days where we go to pizzerias here in the city and they do it with vegan cheese and it's amazing. People love it. We also have a program where we ask one of our regulars what their favorite meal is, and then we kind of make it for them the next week. So we've done like mac and cheese, and we've done some other kind of, you know, pasta foods that they really like. So yeah, so we kind of spice it up a little bit because otherwise people get really tired of just chili.
Yeah, and you mentioned regulars. So yeah, tell us more about the people that you are serving when you're going out and delivering food.
We serve around 200 meals a week now. And some of the people we see them every week, most of them, we know their names, you know, they come by. There's, a lot of them are, people that are currently going through homelessness, and live in shelters and then, stop by and chat. And so it's really about just the human connection too. It's, you know, it's about having a little break of coldness in the world and having some warmth, some human warmth. And we also serve just people that are food insecure, people that might not have a lot of money to get them through the month in terms of food. And so they come for a lunch on a weekend. And so those are families. Some of them are children. And so, you know, also we know them pretty well. And ethnically, they vary. But it is a traditionally Latino neighborhood, the Lower East Side in Manhattan. And so we do meet a lot of Puerto Ricans, you know, young, old. We serve anyone that comes that needs a free lunch.
Very cool. And so you have four core programs for Chili's on Wheels, the first of which being emergency vegan food relief, which is, I assume, kind of what we're talking, the general delivering food to people. But you also have vegan dog food relief, vegan education, and youth engagement. So could you talk about those other three?
Sure. So part of when we started, we were a lot more mobile. We, going throughout the city, we met a lot of people that had their dogs, a lot of people that are homeless right now and have their dogs with them. And so they can't stay in shelters and they can't stay in other covered areas because they don't want to abandon their companions. And, you know, these are like the way they talk about their dogs is, you know, it's really breaks your heart. They're their best friends. They can't live without them. They're the last piece of their lives that they have. They can't bear to part with them. And so sometimes they would even serve the chili that we gave them. They would serve it to the dog. And so we said we have to give some, you know, bring some food out for the whole family. And so we also have vegan food for the dogs. And that's one of our programs. We also do vegan education. We go to schools, community centers, nursing homes, and, you know, bring the message of veganism and how to attain that. Sometimes we target it to low income veganism, which you can totally do, and tips on how to do that. And just talk about the importance of seeing our animal friends as people. And then youth engagement is just what that is, getting children involved in their communities. We don't see a lot of opportunities for children to volunteer. And, we definitely believe in that children need to get out there, be engaged. The more you see the world for what it is, the more apt you are to change it. And if you don't see volunteering as a task or as something that you just, you have to do, or if you see it as part of your life, part of how you're you know, part of your routine, then it's something that you'll grow up with and it'll be part of your routine as an adult as well. And so engaging the youth is a huge part. It's a huge component of what we do. We have partnerships with some high school and college, like freshmen who come out to us, and they're the biggest volunteers that we have, like the most efficient and the most reliable volunteers, actually, which took me by surprise, but it shouldn't. So the youth is a huge component to what we do.
And speaking of youth, it seems like you have a really special bond and connection with your son, Ollie. So you tell us more about him and how he's involved with Chili's on Wheels?
Sure. So Ollie is, he loves the animals. He's a vegan activist. He goes out to the schools with me, and he also talks to the class. He's not shy at all, and he loves the stage. He's part of a theater group in Harlem as well. So he loves the stage, and he loves talking to people, and he loves the animals. And so he's always willing to step up and talk about them and the importance of being vegan. He has his own Instagram account, Vegan Kid Ollie, where he tells me sometimes, like, "Mama, let's do a video so people can go vegan." So he really loves it. And he's involved in everything. I mean, he's the reason why Chili's on Wheels started. It was to get him to see the community. The people there love him, and he loves them. You know, he's making friends and engaging with people and helping. And so he's flourished tremendously. I mean, I've just seen him kind of just take it and run, you know. Yeah, it's really great.
And so Chili's on Wheels is kind of addressing an area of activism that, at least from my vantage point, is typically fairly ignored by vegans. And, food accessibility, and when it is brought up, it's kind of an afterthought. It's never like the main component of the conversation. And so I'm wondering if you agree with that assessment, if vegans are doing a poor job of addressing that issue. And if that is the case, do you have any insight into how we can do better as the vegan community?
I hear a lot of misinformation coming sometimes from the vegan community, and I myself used to kind of spout this information, this idea that if the world were to go vegan, there would be no more hunger. This idea that hunger is somewhat tied to food scarcity, and that is just not true. So there's this talk of if you have an animal and the amount of resources used to feed this animal and raise him and then slaughter him and the amount of people that it would feed. And unfortunately, that's just not the case. And I'm trying to go out there and talk to vegans and go on vegan organizations. I was just at CF United and talking to some activists and just kind of trying to dispel this myth. There's hunger in the world. There's, in the world at large, internationally, and there's hunger in the United States, not because there's a food scarcity, but because there's poverty. And so the two aren't necessarily related as tight as the vegan community sometimes makes it seem. And I think it's a shame. We don't need to lie or exaggerate veganism. Veganism is important because it's a justice issue for the animals. And although we like to sometimes dress it up and talk about the health benefits or talk about, all these other things, we don't actually need to make those claims to be standing on moral ground. We are already standing on moral ground. It's a justice issue. And there are other causes for hunger. So it's about poverty. It's about not having the income to purchase food. And in those respects, there's many things that we as vegans can do. We can volunteer for Chili's on Wheels or other hunger relief organizations, which I've learned there are. We need to do a better job of supporting organizations that already exist. There are Food Not Bombs chapters. There are there's Community Solidarity in Long Island. There are other programs that do this, and if they don't exist, we can also create them. There's a huge lack right now. I see it in food justice. as a field in the community gardens, for example, there's not a lot of vegan influence in these fields. And I'm sure that there's a lot of vegans that like to garden. Why not get involved with the community garden and try to sway the way so that there's no more, you know, chickens in that particular garden? So, you know, we just have to kind of infiltrate these fields that are already in existence and just kind of sway them over to veganism, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I'm curious what kind of reaction you do get from the vegan community, given that what you're doing is something that is more, you know, focused on, or at least seemingly focused on, supplying something for humans and not sort of directly, you know, advocating for animals. Or like, if it seems like people might have that perception of it. So what kind of reaction do you get from the sort of the vegan community as a whole?
You know, for the most part, it's been positive. There's always people that just don't care about other people, and, you know, vegans that don't care about people. And, you know, it's just the way it is, I suppose. But I also bring up the fact that we are advocating for veganism. So I always bring that up when I'm talking to vegans. We're not just feeding people, we're also talking to people about veganism. And the more we bring it out there, the more we engage other people in veganism, people that are, you know, connected to their communities, so it spreads, the better of a chance we have for veganism. And there's people that just say, oh, I would volunteer, but I don't really want to be around people. And I say, well, then I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you could just talk about veganism if that's what you like. You could just hand out flyers. We do that too. So we, you know, we engage a couple of different tactics to try to get everyone on board. And for the most part, the response has been positive. People like to see that veganism is trying to engage all the different communities.
Yeah, I'd imagine that this is just totally speculation, I guess, but that the fact that you are showing such compassion for humans might turn on people to veganism that are otherwise dismissive of it, because it's viewed as like, well, that's just animals and we got to take care of ourselves first. Is that totally off base, or have you had interactions like that?
No, you're right. Some of our volunteers are not even vegan. So that to me tells me that, you know, that it's also a space to do that, to attract people who want to help other people and then, you know, talk to them about veganism as well. So it's kind of, I mean, I think it's a win-win-win-win situation. You know, you're helping people, it's vegan, you're advocating for veganism, and you're advocating, you know, to the volunteers, people that are helping for veganism. So, yeah, and the fact that it's done in a positive way, you know, we're always positive, we're always trying to engage and just, you know, be overwhelmingly smiley and loving. And, you know, that definitely is contagious. And I think it gives, you know, now that I don't know, it gives us a good name for sure. Veganism.
Yes. Awesome. <Yeah. laughs> and in terms of, you said, you know, having conversations with people about veganism, is that a conversation that you're engaging with the people you are giving food to? I guess I'm thinking about experiences I've had. I've done a lot of pay-per-view activism, touring around, and I found myself in cities where, you know, we're paying people a dollar to watch a video, so people experiencing homelessness are attracted to that, and then we're supposed to have a conversation with people about going vegan, but it's a difficult conversation to have because veganism's kind of framed as like vote with your dollar, but if the only dollar they have is the one that you're currently giving them, it just didn't quite sit well with me. And so is that a conversation you're having with people? Do you have any views on that type of conversation and how to handle it? Or if we should even be having that conversation at all with people who are kind of already pretty in a tough situation?
Well, you know, when I first started doing this, there was this one man who approached me and said, I'm so glad that you guys are giving food and not making me sit through a sermon. Because there's a church that goes to the park on during the week who, if they sit through the sermon, then they are fed. Which to me, I mean, it sounds just outrageous. You know, it sounds like blackmailing almost, you know.
Yeah.
And so I would never do that. And so the conversation then is, so do we say anything? We have our leaflets right there. We say that it's vegan. We don't actually force the conversation upon people. So we've had some interesting conversations initiated by some of the folks that we serve that are going through homelessness right now. And it's great, you know, and they're open to hearing about it. But the bulk of the people that we that approach us and talk to us about this and that we then mentor and help are people that perhaps, you know, are people that are considered food insecure. So they're definitely under the poverty line, but they have some choices in regards to what they purchase. And so those are the kind of people that we mostly work with, because, you know, it's something that we can, you know, kind of all relate to. Most of us at some point or another, even when we were just college kids or something, at some point we've been tight on money, and it's a you know, you have to kind of learn how to be vegan under those situations. And it's something that can be done, and it's something that I bring up in my talks and everything. You don't have to go to, you know, Whole Foods or to shop. You know, you can shop in your regular supermarket, and it can still be pretty affordable using food stamps. I mean, there's a way to do it. And so this is where we focus our conversation. It helps that, for example, myself and some of the volunteers have at some point in their lives been on food stamps or have at some point of their lives been under the poverty line. So we know how to manage the situation, and we don't talk from like a kind of a disrespectful or condescending tone, because we've been there. And so we know what it's like. And so the conversation is a little bit different, because it's, in some way, it is our community. And so there's no kind of judgment on that sense. Does that make sense?
It does. It does, definitely. Okay. And speaking of judgment, there's a statement on your website that says, we believe in treating all living beings with kindness, empathy, and respect, regardless of age, race, gender, sexual orientation, language, religion, ability, ethnicity, class, circumstance, environment, level of addiction, or species. And very inclusive, right? But
it's quite a mouthful, yeah.
Yes. The thing that jumped out at me was that second last one, which was level of addiction. And it kind of just sparked in my head how, like, a lot of vegans sort of use the rhetoric of addiction when they're talking about people addicted to cheese and meat and stuff. And perhaps that is insensitive to those that are, you know, in the situations that some of the people you might be serving are in. And
right.
I don't see a lot of empathy for people dealing with addiction from a lot of vegans. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about why that should be included in our moral sphere, as you did include it in your statement on the website.
Oh, wow. Well, this is a little bit, you know, it's a little bit outside of my realm. But we do, you know, we hand out food for the most part, and we do all these things that we've already talked about, but we also sometimes hand out care packages, and in those care packages, you know, you find shampoo, whatever, all vegan. We've contacted vegan organizations, vegan corporations to send us some of their, you know, some of their products, and included in that is condoms, and so there's, I like to say that there's a little bit of harm reduction in our program. And it's just, it's when you're out in the streets and the people that we're meeting, we meet a lot of people that unfortunately are suffering from a particular level of addiction. And that's just the way it is, here in the city particularly. And so I can't really speak about how the words that we use in terms of cheese addiction, how that might, you know, jeez, I don't know.
It's certainly not, I think, a concrete, easy question or answer.
Yeah.
But I was just curious if you had any thoughts on it. But
I know, you know, I don't really have one. I just know that, you know, whenever you're minimizing someone's experience, it's unnecessary. And so really, if we just talk, again, this goes back to when we say that, you know, the veganism is going to solve world hunger. You know, if we just stick to precise language, I think is the best. We don't need to minimize or trivialize anyone's experience. And at the same time, we don't need to make any qualms or any exaggerations, because we already have the moral standpoint. Veganism is justice for the animals. that, I mean, you don't, we don't really have to go and say, well, you're addicted to cheese, or veganism is going to solve world hunger, or, you know, if you're vegan, you won't get cancer. I mean, that's, you don't, we don't need to make those statements, because we don't need to, we already have the moral stand ground. We, veganism is already about justice, and it's already, it's enough. We don't need to keep making all these statements around it.
Right on. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And, you know, I think I certainly also used to fall into that trap of saying veganism is going to end world hunger, because it's in so much of the literature and the books and things that are promoted by vegan organizations. And right. Eventually I kind of stopped using that, because I was like, you know what, that doesn't really make sense to me. I understand resource usage, but I also understand that corporations have no interest in feeding people that they can't profit off of. So I'm always like, well, how is that extra food going to actually make it to people who need it? And it always kind of struck me as just like, for me, when I was doing outreach, it was kind of like, if the person wasn't feeling the arguments, or, you know, the reasons for going vegan because of the animals or the environment or something, then I'd be like, well, what about for humans because of this thing? And it was almost, looking back on it, like a gotcha card, but I was sort of using the suffering of, you know, an immense amount of the population just as my convenient, like, I'm going to make this person feel bad without actually addressing these issues in any other aspect of my life.
Right. And I mean, I definitely understand that. I used to use the same argument, but we can use arguments that are, you know, correct and fact-based. Most of the populations that live around, say, factory farms that are exposed to all this toxic waste are communities of color, are poor communities. And so, I mean, there's, you know, there's arguments that can be raised if you want to bring it to a people argument. You can, using, you know, arguments that are precise and, you know, fact-based. You can also talk about just empathy and how the person benefits from having empathy for animals, because then that builds empathy for people as well. I mean, we can talk about a lot of things that are of benefit to people if they go vegan without having to resort to super huge, super exaggerated arguments.
Definitely.
That are not fact-based, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. We've spent a lot of episodes sort of going over things like that, and been feeling frustrated with the vegan community for propping up certain things, and like you were just saying, we have justice for animals. That's what we have, and that's enough on its own. Mm-hmm. But switching gears just a little bit, okay. when I think about you starting Chili's on Wheels, I imagine you just sort of went to the grocery store or somewhere to procure some beans and tomatoes and whatnot. And I imagine at this point, you said 200 meals a week, correct?
Correct, yeah.
I imagine that it's quite costly, so I'm curious, how is Chili's on Wheels funded at this point? Is it still all out of your pocket? Do you get donations from people?
Okay, so at the beginning, we put this out. We put Chili's on Wheels on a crowdfunding campaign, and we were lucky enough to count with the support of two amazing vegan organizations, Pollination Project and A Well-Fed World, who helped us to start it off. But we do rely on individual donations. And I think it's really important for vegans to donate if they're able, if they have the means, to donate to organizations that are vegan, not necessarily just Chili's on Wheels, although all donations are appreciated, but also to just in general to other vegan organizations, because without you, we don't have a place to lean on. We don't have anyone else to lean on. So we really do lean on, you know, whoever can send us whatever, $20, $30, you know, other foundations, where you would typically, other organizations would typically, you know, send grants to and look for funds, are not willing to donate to vegan organizations, for whatever reason. You know, they don't want the message to go out. They don't want, you know, they're supported by whoever they're supportive, whatever interests. But the case is that vegan organizations don't get the fair package. So we really do rely on individuals, people that are concerned for us. And that also includes companies and corporate, you know, we also are lucky enough to count with friends and have vegan companies that say the same thing. You know, vegans need to support vegan companies as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And something I wanted to circle back to as well is you mentioned chapters had popped up in other places. Where are those chapters now? And if someone was interested in starting their own chapter, how could they do that?
All right, so we have chapters in a couple of cities, Baltimore, Denver, San Diego, Puerto Rico. And if you're interested in setting up a chapter, just send us an email. We partially fund the chapters, but we help you set it all up. We have a director of chapter development, a volunteer who loves doing this and can help you check out your area, see what you need to start, and just help you set it all up.
Right on. And we are coming to the end of our time. So how can people get in touch with you in terms of website, social media, anything else you would direct people towards?
Okay, so we are Chili's on Wheels. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our website is chilisonwheels.org.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you, Andy. I had a great time. Thank you so much.
So we hope you enjoyed that interview with Michelle Carrera, the founder of Chili's on Wheels. Again, you can check out all of the articles that we talked about, all of the places that we've eaten over at thecommentist.com. I know you already heard that great advertisement for it, so I'm not going to spell it out for you again. But but please check out thecommentist.com. Check out Chili's on Wheels. Andy, what else should we check out?
They can check me out at an upcoming event.
Not planned.
High five for that, Paul. Nice setup. Yeah, I will be at the Colorado Veg Fest in Golden, Colorado, July 23rd and 24th. I'll be at the Pittsburgh Veg Fest in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, July 30th. And then I will be at the Western New York Veg Fest in Buffalo, New York on August 7th. And I will be behind the Compassion Company table. So you can get all the dates, deets, and links for that at CompassionCo.com. That's just CompassionCO.com. And come by, tell me what's good, tell me what's bad, and tell me where we should go eat a meal together.
And I will be watching the movie At the Fork, either in Bridgeport or Berlin, Connecticut.
So go find Paul and sit behind him and breathe really loud.
And bring your children and talk to them through the whole movie.
Yes, please.
So I think that's all we got for today.
That is true, Paul.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off.